His current and very important book, NEA Trojan Horse in American Education, promises to make an even greater impact on our nation. Thank you, Mr. Blumenfeld, for your courage to tell the truth, and we welcome you and look forward to what you have to say to us today.
Thank you, Colleen, very much. It's a great pleasure indeed to be here and to see so many wonderful, eager young people interested in this particular subject at certainly a turning point in our nation's history. And all of us are going to be facing very, very difficult days ahead because obviously we are going to confront the establishment on a very wide front, and I don't know how bloody it's going to be. But certainly, judging from what we heard last night concerning what's happening in the Washington State Legislature and the passage of this homeschooling bill, which is imminent, the governor seems to be hesitating in signing it. There is a confrontation in the making. And it's going to become necessary for homeschoolers certainly to organize and to let it be known that parents are reasserting their unalienable right to educate their children without interference from the state. This is an unalienable right that was given to every parent by the Creator. It existed even before the Declaration of Independence put it down on paper. You cannot take an unalienable right away. And so the parents of America are going to have to reassert that right, not only in the state of Washington, but throughout the nation. The bill, as far as I can see, is simply they're following the guidelines that the NEA has laid down for homeschooling. And of course, you know why they want to control homeschooling, because they're afraid that education is going to get out of their hands. And that's the last thing they want. In 1776, the Founding Fathers wrote our famous declaration in which they said that all men were created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, including among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that the purpose of government is to secure those unalienable rights, not to deprive the citizens of them, not to deny them, but to secure them, to make sure that the citizen can exercise his or her unalienable rights. And this is what we've got to begin telling our public servants. They must never forget that they are public servants, even though they are acting like public masters. You are still paying their salaries. They should be made aware of that occasionally. But apparently the parents of America have been on the defensive too long, and it's going to be very soon time to go on the offensive. Remember, when the Founding Fathers wrote the Declaration of Independence, King George did not hand them their freedom on a silver platter. They went through 6 long years of blood, sweat, and tears before they finally achieved what they had said they wanted in the Declaration. And of course, many paid with their lives. Their homes, their families were ruined. They suffered a great deal just so that we could enjoy those unalienable rights. And of course, the problem in the United States is that too many Christians have been surrendering those rights without a fight, have been literally been giving them to the state without even knowing what they were doing. And the state, of course, has been only too happy to take them. You know, it's like taking unalienable rights away from Christians is like taking candy from a baby. democracy in many respects. And it is the few who have stood up and resisted this, as, for example, in Nebraska, where the difference has been made and where the battle lines have been formed. And, of course, so you know you are here because you realize that, and this battle is going to rage on. So organization is necessary for Christians to reassert parental rights. And today's parents must write a new Declaration of Independence and serve notice on all of those officials and legislators that the gauntlet has been thrown, and there is a war ahead. Because I don't know what you're going to have to do to change the minds of the Washington legislators, but this seems to be the case throughout the country. Some states are more lenient than others, but apparently Washington has decided that it's going to try to stop the Christians and stop the homeschoolers. In any case, getting back to my topic, religion in American intellectual life, of course, as Rush said, you cannot separate religion from education. And our founding fathers knew that very well. In fact, you could, if you want to understand what has happened to religion in America, all you do is have to understand what's happened to education. And we start basic, you could say that American education has really gone through three very specific phases. The first one being the Calvinist phase. The Calvinist phase I would date from the founding of the colonies right through perhaps around 1830 or so, when the Calvinist worldview lost its dominant position in the United States. Well, what was the Calvinist worldview? It was based on the idea that, of course, that God was sovereign, that his law was supreme, that life was God-centered, that man was indeed a fallen creature whose only protection lay in his adherence and covenant with the Lord, and that was his only salvation, basically. And the people who came to this country wanted to create basically a Bible commonwealth. That's why the Pilgrims and the Puritans came to the United States. That's why they left England. They were separatists. They wanted to be able to lead the full life that the Bible outlines for them. And so they came to these shores and they created schools. They created Harvard University, as a matter of fact. When the Massachusetts Bay Colony was only 6 years old, they were already in the process of creating a university. These men were highly educated, cultivated men. They knew Latin, they knew Greek, they knew Hebrew, and they brought all of this to the wilderness of New England and began setting up these institutions in the wilderness in order to glorify God. That was the purpose of life for the Calvinists, to glorify God. And so all of education was conducted around that basic concept. And the purpose of Harvard University was to create a learned clergy, a clergy that knew Latin and Greek and Hebrew, and could read the scriptures in the original languages. The scriptures were the heart of the community. And each community was dominated by the church. And America was pretty much of a Calvinistic country until well into the 1830s. And of course, you know, the Calvinists in New England were centered mainly around Congregationalism, in New Jersey around Presbyterianism, and there were Calvinist Baptists. There were other denominations, but certainly the Calvinists were the ones who not only created the basic cultural foundation of this nation, but also its political form, its political system. The Declaration of Independence certainly proclaims the origin of man's unalienable rights. They come from the Creator. And of course, the Constitution is a very Calvinist doctrine because it understands human nature. It understands the nature of fallen man and the fact that he cannot be trusted with power. And that is why the Constitution created these separation of powers and broke power up into as many small pieces as possible so that no single individual could ever gain so much power as to overwhelm others. Because it isn't, as the Calvinists believe, it wasn't power that corrupts man, it's man that corrupts power. And whatever man touches, he seems to corrupt. In any case, there's a very big difference between Calvinism and Lutheranism as far as politics go. Let me read you something that I copied from the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica on this particular point. The Encyclopedia writes, "Luther gave little attention to New Testament polity, though he believed and clung passionately to the universal priesthood of all true Christians and rejected the idea of a sacerdotal caste. He had no dream or vision of the church's spiritual independence and prerogative. He was content that ecclesiastical supremacy should be with the civil power, and he believed that the work of the Reformation would in that way be best preserved. While it was different with the reformers outside Germany, they drew their ideas of church polity directly from the New Testament. When the conclusions thus reached by many independent investigators were at length reduced to a system by Calvin in his famous Institutes, it became the definite ideal of church government for all the reformed in contradistinction to the Lutheran churches." In other words, Calvin held that the church must be independent of the state. His experience was completely different from Luther's because he, of course, was persecuted. He was a Frenchman and fled to Geneva, where he created what would be considered probably the best-known Calvinist political entity that ever existed. But it was his distrust of the state, and of course of the King of France, which he based the need for the church to be independent. And of course, even in the introduction to the Institutes, he comes out and says that if the state requires of you to do anything in disobedience to God's law, you just pay no attention to it. And that really is the heart of American freedom, is that God's law is supreme. The Constitution was made under God's law. And therefore, the Constitution is in obedience to God's law. And when that Constitution is perverted, it is not to be obeyed. And that's particularly true in the instance of unalienable rights, where the parents' right to educate their children at home is an unalienable right. It was exercised by the citizens of this country before the first compulsory school attendance laws were passed. When was the first public school attendance law passed? In 1850. So for a considerable time, parents did exercise that right. And it was the normal way of educating children. The home is the normal school. The school itself is a rather artificial entity, and certainly the public school is. The Calvinist period lasted until about 1830, and then we enter what I call the Hegelian period. The transition took place, it's rather amazing how early in this country the rebellion against Calvinism took place. And where did it take place? In the heart of the Calvinist Commonwealth in New England at Harvard University, where the Unitarians took power in 1805. Now, who were the Unitarians? Actually, the Unitarianism began basically at the same time that Calvinism began, way in the 1500s. But the Unitarians denied the divinity of Christ. They denied the Trinity. That's where you get the term Unitarian. They denied the Trinity, the triune God. And for a while, they seemed to espouse a kind of monotheism. They weren't Jews. It wasn't Judaism, certainly. And, of course, their great leader, Ellery Channing, more or less formulated their philosophy during their when they were growing in Boston. Of course, they were greatly influenced by the Enlightenment period, the ideas of the Enlightenment. But the denial of the divinity of Christ meant that salvation was no longer possible through religion. And so the emphasis changed. In other words, first of all, they believed that man was not the innately depraved character that Calvin wrote about. They believed that man was not only not innately depraved, but that he was innately good. Not only was he basically good, he was perfectible. They felt in a sense that Calvin had libeled man, and that the reason why man acted the way he did was because of this auto-suggestion, that he'd been told over and over again that he was basically evil, fallen, sinful, and therefore he was simply behaving in the manner that the Bible was saying that he was behaving. And so they said, no, that's not true. Man is basically rational, perfectible, etc., and that the means to... But of course, then they were confronted with the whole problem of evil. Well, if man is this wonderful creature you say he is, why does he murder so much? Why does he create so much mayhem? Well, they said, well, the reasons, of course, are poverty, ignorance, and social injustice. Well, you can take care of ignorance very easily through education. And once you've taken care of ignorance, then you eliminate poverty, and then you've eliminated social injustice. What a wonderful program. And so they said, let's get the schools away from religion. We'll create these secular schools that will only deal in the observable facts of life and the world, and everything will be great. And so they preceded Horace Mann and the other Unitarians in promoting the public school movement in divorcing education from religion. But of course, the Unitarians had their own religion. It was not an education without religion. It was an education with a new religion based upon the divinity of man. There's a beautiful, great statue of William Ellery Channing in Boston. I come from a city where all of this happened, and it's very easy to see the monuments. We have the first Unitarian church in Boston, and then we have the statue of William Ellery Channing, and this is what the inscription says on that statue. It says, "He breathed into theology a humane spirit and proclaimed anew the divinity of man." Man is God, and this business of the humane spirit. You see, the Unitarian rebels could not tolerate this tyrannical Calvinistic God, you see. And there's even a passage where Channing said that even if such a God did exist, we would not bow down to him because he's a tyrant, you see. They forget all the blessings that God gives them. They forget that they were given the gift of life to begin with and that everything they have came from the Lord. But this is, of course, human egotism at its height. It's amazing that it should have grown up in the Calvinist Commonwealth, but I suppose that was the consequence of their corruption, of their self-corruptibility. And on the statue it also says, he preached with spiritual power and led a great advance toward the Christian ideals. That's when they began to divorce. That's when they divorced theology from Christianity, and it became a sort of ethical culture, you know. And that's where Christianity begins to lose its covenantal character and becomes a kind of social religion or a religion of ideas, a philosophical religion. But I could not understand Christianity until I read Calvin and realized that Christianity is a covenant religion in which each individual has a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ, the very same covenant religion that is in the Old Testament, the covenant made by God with Abraham. And Christ simply extended that covenant to the rest of mankind, simply beginning with the Jewish people and then extending it to the Gentile. But it's the covenant idea that makes Christianity what it is. And when you separate the covenant idea, you get into this kind of spiritual philosophical religion, which fit in very well what was happening in Germany at the time. Now, I call this period the Hegelian period because that is when the philosophy of George Hegel arose in Germany. Now, let me say one other thing. The Calvinist period, of course, is one characterized by a very high standard of literacy. Well, you had to know Greek and Latin and Hebrew as well as English. So, and these were taught right there in the wilderness, in many families. Some of you are going to have to learn some Latin and Greek and Hebrew to teach your children at home. Prepare yourselves. Well, as I say, the second period lasted from the 1830s or 40s until World War I, the Hegelian period. It was the period in which Hegel's statist idealist philosophy spread throughout the Western world like a malignant spiritual disease, destroying Calvinism in its wake. Calvinism was really the target. Not Lutheranism as much, but Calvinism was certainly the target. Hegel dethroned the Jehovah of the Old Testament and the Christ of the New Testament. In their place, he offered a pantheistic view of the universe in which everything that existed was a somewhat formless God in the process of perfecting himself through a dynamic, endless struggle called the dialectic. I'm sure many of you have heard of the dialectic. In this scheme, man became the highest manifestation of God in the universe, and as one Hegelian American educator put it, man is divinity awaking out of the sleep of infinitely self-expanded being. The dialectic, of course, was this business of Hegel believed that all of the universe was God in the process of perfecting himself. It's an interesting idea. He said that this process was composed of a thesis, of and then an antithesis, and then a clash, a struggle, a violent struggle between the two to create a new synthesis. And this synthesis then became the new thesis with another antithesis, because he was amazed by the contradictions. Contradiction, you see, makes for progress, because you get the clash of contradictions and then you get a higher stage of development. And according to Hegel, this was the process whereby man was getting better and better. This was the process whereby man was becoming morally better and better. Moral progress was being made. But you can see there's a tremendous amount of violence in that process. It's not a a harmonizing process. It's one in which violence and contradiction and struggle becomes really the center of existence. It becomes the very form of history. And of course, when the communists took over that dialectic and threw out the idealism, they had no use for this pantheistic mysticism. They just said it's all matter in motion. That became the Marxian dialectical materialism. And if you want to understand the communist mind, you've got to understand their religion, because they do have a religion, and it is dialectical materialism. And that's why they believe that there is constant violence and struggle necessary, as communism and capitalism are in this inevitable and endless struggle to produce a new higher synthesis. And that's why you keep having wars of liberation, and that's why the communists never stop what they're doing. The violence never stops, because it's in their philosophy. They believe it. And they believe that they, and the communists themselves believe that they are the instruments of that whole violent process, that they can lead the process, that they are the chosen who can lead that violent process to its ultimate conclusion. God only knows what that conclusion is. But in this pantheist scheme of things, the purpose of life was to glorify man and the instrument through which his collective power could be exercised, the state. And that's the beginning of European statism, which was to lead to, of course, these almighty states with their supreme laws that then led them into a world war. First the Franco-Prussian War, then World War I, and World War II, and then now into our present state system, that is the world system of national states in which each state is sovereign, and the sovereignty of state law overrides every other law there is. Now, it is during this Hegelian period that the public school movement developed, promoting a secular form of education which gradually eliminated the Bible from the classrooms of America. So you have the Unitarians and the Hegelians and also the socialists, the Owenites who came to to our shores in the early part of the century and believed that religion and the free enterprise system and capitalism were the cause of evil. See, they all have to identify the cause of evil. And they all decided that religion was the cause of evil. And so if you get rid of religion, you're going to have unlimited good. If you get rid of the restraints that God has placed on man's behavior, you will have unlimited good. But of course, we've seen the results. If man is has gotten any better as a result of this dialectical process, all I have to do is tell you to turn on your television set and you can see how much he has improved. You know. So obviously, what is wrong with man has not been cured by the dialectic. In fact, it has simply shown us to what depths of human depravity, human beings can fall. I mean, we have seen such depravity that I don't think even Calvin could have imagined, with concentration camps and slaughter and exterminations and gulags and... In fact, the humanists have created hell on earth. That's what they'd like to do in the United States as well. Hell on earth. Well, yet even the Hegelian period was one of high literacy. For Hegel had stressed intellectual development since he considered man's mind to be the highest manifestation of God in the universe. Latin and Greek were studied, not because they were the languages of Scripture, but because they were the languages of the pagan classics. That's where the shift took place. You see, you could no longer study the Bible, so you studied the Aeneid and the Odyssey and all of the works of the Greeks and the Romans, etc. Discipline, punctuality, high academic standards, and achievement were the hallmarks of the public schools during that period. And of course, that's what they always talk about when they say, let's get back to the old days, back to the basics. They're really talking about the Hegelian school, which was a very efficient place. I went to a Hegelian school, basically. Anyone who went to a public school before 1930, it was a Hegelian classroom with the seats bolted down to the floor and the uniform rows and the silence, and it worked very well. It did its job beautifully. And today's, and there are many humanists today who would, or lovers of the humanities, who would like to return to that form of education that existed prior to the takeover by the progressives. For example, the Paideia movement. I don't know how many of you are aware of the Mortimer Adlis Paideia proposal, which basically is to get us back to the great books idea, get back to the Greeks and the Romans, etc., the pagan classics. And that's basically trying to get back to the Hegelian period, which was one, as I say, of high literacy. The third period, which began around World War I and has lasted to the present, can be designated the progressive period. It came into being mainly as a result of the new behavioral psychology developed in the experimental laboratories of Wilhelm Wundt at the University of Leipzig in Germany. The major American figures who studied under Wundt and came back to the United States to revolutionize American education were James McKean Cattell, G. Stanley Hall, Charles H. Judd, and James Earl Russell. Dewey was one of them, but he didn't go to Germany. Dewey got his education here at Johns Hopkins University and then at the University of Michigan, and then created his laboratory school at the University of Chicago. Science and evolution replaced religion as the focus of their faith, and dialectical materialism superseded Hegel's dialectical idealism as the process by which man's moral progress was made. The word progressive, in fact, comes from this dialectical conception of progress. You've heard of, he's a progressive. What they mean is basically he believes in the dialectic. And when you are a reactionary, you are reacting against the thesis, you see. That's what a reactionary is somebody involved in this dialectical process who is trying to stop the new synthesis from coming into being. The pioneer in the progressive movement who beat the first path to Wundt's laboratory in Leipzig was G. Stanley Hall. Hall had already spent the years 1868 to 70 studying in Germany and had returned to the United States seething with hatred for his Puritan New England heritage. He wrote in his autobiography, quote, "I fairly loathed and hated so much that I saw about me that I now realize more clearly than ever how possible it would have been for me to have drifted into some, perhaps almost any camp of radicals, and to have come into such open rupture with the scheme of things as they were, that I should have been stigmatized as dangerous, at least for any academic career, where the motto was safety first. And as this was the only way left open, the alternative being the dread one of going back to the farm, it was most fortunate that these deeply stirred instincts of revolt were never openly expressed and my rank heresies and socialistic leanings unknown," unquote. Well, they were all basically socialists because they all had to deal with the problem of evil. And so they had to blame something. Well, so they blamed capitalism, you see, as well as religion. And so they decided that socialism would cure mankind's moral diseases. And, of course, they took over the education system. Here, what happened during that period was the marriage between psychology and education. A very important development, which I'm afraid is never mentioned in any of the textbooks. But it's vital in understanding what's happened to American education that it has become therapy, because it is now completely controlled by the behavioral psychologists. And the behavioral psychologists lifted education to the graduate level. You see, prior to that, even during the Hegelian period, teachers went to normal schools for their training, or to institutes or academies. There was no such thing as a doctor of education. Doctor of what? you know, education. Harvard didn't produce its first Doctor of Education until around 1920. It was the behavioral psychologists that created the first graduate schools of education, Columbia University Teachers College, Cumberley's department down at Stanford, the department at the University of Chicago. That's when the universities began creating their graduate programs in education, mainly because, and the reason why the psychologists attached themselves to education is because there was no other practical use for behavioral psychology. Really, apart from education, if you got behavioral psychology out of education, there'd be very little practical use for it. Maybe, you know, perhaps examining the behavior of people in supermarkets and that sort of thing, but certainly it would have very little relevance. So the marriage between education and psychology lifted them both up to a new, higher, exalted level in our society, and the foundations came in, poured money into them, and of course today they're all supported by huge federal grants that come into them. But what was the purpose of man's life at that point? You see, at the beginning and during the Calvinist period, it was to glorify God. In the Hegelian period, it was to glorify man. In the progressive period, the purpose of the system is to separate man from God permanently, to blaspheme God, to deny God. You see, in idolizing science, science became their God. Let me just read to you some quotes from Cattell. James McKean Cattell, who is incidentally responsible for starting us on the road to Lookay reading, which I will talk about this afternoon. He said, "Science has freed us from superstition and unreason." Their Christian religion was superstition and unreason. "It is in itself the most perfect art and the best religion, the force, not ourselves, that makes for truth and righteousness." So science is a religion that makes for truth and righteousness. And he did more than any other man in his generation to bring about the organization of science in America into the vast, gigantic, atheistic field that it is today, based on evolution, on man as animal. But it's very interesting. While Cattell believed in all of this, he also believed in homeschooling for his own children. Listen to what Thorndike says about him when he died. He says, "Cattell believed in the possibility of a science of education and was on the lookout for educational implications in his experiments on perception, association, and individual differences. He had theories about the educative process, notably the theory that a home with many children of different ages was in certain respects superior to a classroom filled with children as nearly alike as possible." And then Cattell himself once said, "Mankind will last only so long as children are born and cared for, and no plausible substitute for the family has been proposed. The school, by its nature, weakens the family, for it takes the children away from home and gives them interests not centered in the home." So it was all right for him. Isn't that curious? Well, of course, he knew the way they were teaching children to read in the public schools, and that's why he kept his children at home to make sure that they would learn to read. But so we go from the purpose of life being to glorify God to the purpose of life being to blaspheme God, to separate oneself from God, to destroy the work of Christ. As a matter of fact, in reading the biographies of these men like John Dewey and Cattell and the others, you find out that they all came from good Christian families. How curious. Dewey was brought up by a New England, a Vermont Christian family. He attended church. He even taught Sunday school. And yet, through the process, when he became finally a dialectical materialist, or materialist of some kind, he spent the rest of his professional life doing everything in his power to destroy Christianity and the work of Jesus Christ, and substituting in its place a new religion called humanism. He, of course, was one of the signers of the Humanist Manifesto. Now, there's a difference between somebody who falls away from his religion and becomes indifferent to it. There are many like that, you know. Most people are that sort. They're indifferent to religion. But when you spend your entire professional life, as did Dewey, Thorndike, Cattell, and these others, doing everything in your power to destroy Christianity, to destroy the work of Jesus Christ, then those individuals, without a doubt in my mind, are under satanic influence, are basically Satanists, because they are doing the work of Satan. And what is Satan's ultimate goal? It is to separate man from God. And once you separate man from God, you can do anything you want to him. And that is what the public schools of America have been doing for at least the last 50 years, separating the children from God, doing everything in their power to separate the children from their Creator. And that's why the public school is such a dangerous place, because the children are at risk in three areas. They're at risk academically, we know that, because the entire curriculum has been constructed around the idea of separating the children from God, of destroying their faith, of destroying Christianity. So we know that academically they become intellectual cripples. They are at risk spiritually because of the undermining of their faith. And of course they are at risk morally because they come in contact with drug pushers, the sexually promiscuous or precocious, the assaults, the robberies, etc., that go on in school, the immorality. And so children in the public schools are very much at risk in all of these areas. And as long as the philosophy of education is that, and is basically state is the separation of man from God, there is no hope for the system. It can't possibly be reformed in any way, shape, or form. But you must also realize, and I think homeschoolers must realize this, that the public school is an artificial creation made for the convenience of the state and the educators and the bureaucrats, and it has nothing to do with education, nothing to do with true learning. It is an institution of manipulation and control, strictly manipulation and control. And that's why they are so fearful of Christians getting out of the system. They want your children in their computers, remember. And that's why this bill in Washington is so dangerous, because they'll get you into their computer, because that certified teacher is going to be at your house every week or whatever the schedule will be. And you will have to account for what you're teaching your children, you see. So there is, we've reached the stage now where we must return to the original purpose of education, based on the true purpose of life, the true reason for living, and that is to glorify God. And you can see that we're going in full circle. We've been through it all. We've been through the atheism, and we've been through it all. The other day I was speaking in I was visiting a Bell Fountain, a town in Ohio, attending church, a fundamentalist church that was being held in a school building, in an elementary school building. And so I had a chance to look at the books on the teacher's desk in this elementary school. And I was going through this one reading textbook, which is used in English, or reading, I don't know what they call communications these days, you don't know what they call it. But in any case, in vain I looked through that book to see the word God mentioned. Not a single story in which God even exists. no ministers, no churches, complete absence of any reference to religion of any kind. Lots of stories about animals, animals that speak, animals that do all kinds of wonderful things, and human beings with all kinds of wonderful relationships with the animals. And no even mention that there is a God. And I realized what was being done in that, by that book. You see, they are giving the child the impression that religion is unreal, but the book that they have is real. That's the real world. But that all of these loony people out there who go to church, there's something wrong with them. And yet these children live in a town where there's a church on almost every corner, where they know ministers, where they go to church. So you're having two realities that are battling for dominance, two realities. And the schools are pouring it on. In the last 5 years, the humanists have opened up all the stoppers. All the stoppers. It is being poured on in a manner that is frightening. And the result is you're getting students getting involved with satanic cults, animal mutilation, warlocks, witches, witchcraft. Everything is happening. It's really frightening, this epidemic of Satanism that is now just running rampant throughout the nation, and it's affecting the children. The children are being, and you know, death education that's being pushed through the schools, pure Satanism, absolute Satanism, encouraging the children to write suicide notes and their obituaries and all kinds of things. And the children, of course, are committing suicide. Suicide is now the second highest cause of death among youngsters in America. So it is having an incredible effect. Well, I've given you an outline of the development of American education and the removal of God. It's not neutral, though, the public schools. They're satanic. It's not merely an absence of religion. It's an imposition of Satanism in very strong doses these days. And this afternoon I will then go into more detail on the specifics of the reading problem and how that fits into this whole picture. Thank you very much.